It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
The following podcast is hashtag Boone approved. It's time for another edition of the Brett Boone Podcast.
Remember when me and you almost went to blows? Lou sent me down three times too, so I know what you're talking about.
With your host, MLB All-Star, Brett Boone.
Bottom line is, you will become a successful major league hitter by hitting pitcher's mistakes.
As he sits down with his sports and entertainment friends from around the world.
You are not going to be a successful major league hitter if you hit pitcher's pitches.
This isn't just any former jocks podcast.
To change the outcome, you got to change the income. You got to change what goes in. Then that changes what goes out.
Often duplicated, but never replicated. Just like his bat flip.
Okay, now the party starts. The responsibility starts now.
Now in its fourth year, this is the one and only Brett Boone Podcast.
Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. I am Brett Boone, and today on the program, I sit down with an eight-year big league veteran. I knew him as a kid. I knew him when he's just about to get drafted. He was 18 years old. Now broadcast game for the San Diego Padres, and I look forward with spending a little time with, ladies and gentlemen, Tony Gwynn Jr. Tony, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me, Booney. How are you?
I'm doing good. We'll get to the Padres in a second. I want to talk a little bit about your life. I was thinking about it last night. Your dad retired after the 01 season. You got drafted in 2000, then went on to play for your dad at San Diego State. So we're one of the few, you know, I played, my son and daughter got to see me play up till they were 8 or 9 years old.
Yeah.
We essentially got to spend our entire childhood through high school. For me, I was in the minor leagues. My dad was still playing.
Yeah.
Watching our dads, being around the game. I talk about on the podcast all the time. My childhood growing up, I went, you know, from Philly running around with Pete Rose and Steve Carlton and Mike Schmidt and the Bull, Luzinski. To then he got traded to the Angels, and it was Reggie Jackson and it was Rod Carew. So I had a pretty cool childhood being around the game. I never really got into it with you. I saw you. I was briefly, me and your father played together briefly, only the 2000 season. Every time I talk to you, I always say it. I said, man, it's like I'm talking to Pops, that same voice. I love my brief time with your dad, but I didn't really get to know you much, but I know you were coming around the ballpark. At that stage of your life, you know, you're busy. You got high school things to do. You got proms to go to. You got baseball practice. You got drafted that year. You're not around the game as much at the ballpark. But tell me about your childhood in those early years. Did you tag along? Did Pops let you tag along with him?
I definitely did. It took him a little bit of time for him to feel comfortable with me kind of tagging along. And there's a couple of things he was concerned with. And I'm sure this is the same for your Pops. Making sure they could protect themselves, you know, on the field, because, you know, they had jobs to do. So it was tough to watch us the entire time. So they had to trust that we could, A, protect ourselves when we were on that field. But I think more importantly was, for my dad, at least, he was big on me understanding that although it was a game to me and it was a lot of fun, that this was guys' livelihood. This is how they fed their family. And I needed to have a certain respect for those guys when I walked in there. And so once he felt like there was at least some understanding of that, which was about the age of 9 for me, is when he started to allow me to come to the field and hang out and be around those guys more often. And so, you know, from 9 till, I say, I got to 16, 17, when I got to high school, I was pretty much at the yard. That is where a lot of my life lessons honestly came from, was being in that clubhouse, traveling around with my dad, getting to see these guys work on an everyday basis. And it really shaped, I think, a lot of my, not only baseball life, but just life in general.
Isn't it amazing, though? because as kids, we don't know any better. And like you said, you want a dad. You realize as an adult, once you become a big leaguer, you're like, okay, now I know what dad was going through worrying about me. When we're kids, we're like, what are you worried about, dad? This is a playground for us, you know?
Right.
And I have so many fond memories where we're just, you're a kid, you just don't know any better. And I remember the days, Tony, when I'd say, dad, what time are we going to the ballpark? He'd say, you're not going to go today. What? What? That's the end of my earth. I got to go to the yard. I got to put my uniform on. The city expects little Boone to be there 100%. In the outfield. And I can't explain it to people. Like, it rocked my world more than you know. I'd go into like depression for a night. Like, there's no way. That's not letting me go to the game.
That's a lot of time how they kept us in line was, hey, if you want to have a chance to go to the park, you better get XYZ done, or you better not act a certain way. That's how they kept me in line most of the time.
And then it starts. It's like, mom, what time are we going to the game? Well, we're going to get there on time. I got to get there early because I got to get downstairs and just show that I'm here. I got to go help the Philly Fanatic tonight. I got to help him in between sets. But yeah, the thing that looks back, and nothing, like I said, nothing but the fondest memories. I think when I was a little kid, and I think all of us, you know, we take it for granted. That's all we knew. This is what dad does. He goes to work and we hang out.
It was funny because, especially after I became a big leaguer and I got to be around, you know, someone like Davey Lopes for the second time. Davey was hitting me ground balls when I was 11, 12 years old. And at the time, you know, it's just one of the coaches. But once you get into the game and the history of it, you realize, man, this dude was a dude. And now he's on the coaching side, also being that great. And so, you know, it's those lessons that, you know, you get a chance. I mean, obviously, I came up in there when you had the Ricky Hendersons, the King Griffey Juniors, the Will Clarks of the world, right? And these are guys that I loved watching. And, you know, as you get to the big leagues, you start to understand, man, like, what they did is not easy. Like, this sport that we love so much that has been a game and so much fun, you start to see the type of work that has to be put in order to have any success at all, especially at that level.
I laugh when people, you know, especially when we were first breaking in, well, it's much easier for you. You grew up in the game. I said, well, I grew up in the game, but that didn't help me hit. That didn't help me get to this level. No. So I simplified my answer. Did it help you? I don't know how much it helped me, but I know it didn't hurt me. I know playing, because our dads played during our entire childhood, people don't understand. They go to the ballpark at 3 o'clock. We get out of school at 3 o'clock. So right. Dad wasn't right there on the little league practices and coaching. And I tell this to this day. I said, my dad didn't help me one thing baseball. He didn't teach me how to throw, didn't teach me how to hit, didn't teach me how to do anything physically. He taught me how to behave. He taught me how to act like a pro. That was the main thing I've got out of my dad. And being around him his entire career is the way he carried himself, the way he acted. Yeah. That really grounded me and enabled me to have maybe a tiny bit of an easier transition. But I'll tell you, once I got on a big league field, even though we grew up around him all the time, stepping in a box that first time in a big league yard, it's just different. And I can't explain it to people. It was as different for me as any young guy going, even though I grew up in it.
You can't prepare yourself for it. You just can't. And I'll say this in terms of, did it help or hurt? It certainly gave me, I felt like it gave me an advantage on how to conduct myself as a big leaguer. How the locker room kind of pecking order went. Like, I had a great understanding of that from the very first day I ever walked into a professional locker room. And it certainly helped me in terms of, you know, veterans respected that when you walked in, you knew how to be a pro at an early age. And so from that standpoint, it definitely was an advantage, because so often most people that's not in our shoes, they're they're just going off of either what they've heard or what they think. There's no actual foundation there to go off of. So I always tried to show those guys grace because I knew I was a little bit different. I had an advantage going in terms of that. But as you said, in terms of the on the field stuff, there's not a whole lot that can prepare you for what it feels like to step into the box of a big league yard. And my dad was similar. You know, my dad was at the field. He got there early. He was there at like one. So there was no chance of me ever seeing him after school unless it was a day game and he was coming. They happened to get done early. You know, that was pretty much it. And, you know, the interesting thing is, although I saw that a lot growing up, it still took me some time, even as a pro, to kind of understand how to go about that process. I seen it, but applying it as a whole is a whole nother thing and a whole nother journey in itself.
Yeah, I can picture right now at Jack Murphy Stadium. You know, the cage for us was upstairs. We had to take an elevator to it. And your dad, you're right. The 1 year I played, he was there every day. I walk in. I said, T, what's going on? Hey, Booney, come on in. I said, T, we can't talk hitting. You're left-handed, and you just don't. It doesn't relate to my right-handed swing. And it's this Smolt slider I got to chase tonight. He'd laugh at me, you know, with that belly laugh. And man, I really did enjoy my time. You played for him at San Diego State. Now, the only thing I can compare to that is, in 1993, I got traded from the Cincinnati Reds from the Seattle Mariners to Cincinnati Reds. I get a call from Davey Johnson, who was the skipper in Cincinnati. He said, Brett, I just want to reach out. Really excited to have you. You know, you're going to be our second baseman, this and that. And I remember him. I'm sitting there. I was at my dad's house. And he says, Brett, is your dad around? Because Davey and my dad had played together. And I said, well, that's kind of a weird question, but he happens to be here. I put him on the phone. About 5 minutes later, he comes back in. He goes, how would you feel about me being your bench coach in Cincinnati? Tony, this is all right. I just got kind of established in Seattle and then I got traded. And now my dad's going to be there watching over my shoulder. I'm like, come on, this is the worst. I was going to tell him he couldn't take the job. So he accepts the job as bench coach. I'll tell you this, to this day, it's one of the best, most enjoyable, rewarding seasons I've ever had, was having my dad there with me. And I thought it was going to be a nightmare. Like, I was in high school and he was monitoring me. And we talk about that professionalism. It was nothing but the opposite. I mean, we walked through those doors at Riverfront Stadium. It was coach player. And he hung with the coaches. He did not get in. He was the ultimate professional. But the nice part of it was, on an off day, I got to go to lunch with my dad.
Yeah.
So I really treasured that time. And I thought it was going to be the worst, and it ended up being the best. Talk about you, even at a younger age, playing college baseball. Now dad's coming in. I know early he came in as an assistant, and then he took over.
Yeah. So, you know, part of the reason I ended up going to state was because they had already started the plans of him possibly taking over once he retired. Now, in 2000, when initially I signed to go to play at Cal State Fullerton, about 2 weeks after he kind of came into the room, I think Coach Dietz had kind of been needling him about taking the job and him holding on to it until he was ready. And, you know, after that 2000 season for him, I think he started to come to wrap his mind around the fact that his knee wasn't getting any better and it was going to be hard for him to play the game the way he wanted to play. And so I think at that point he started, it was like perfect timing, right? I think it would have been a tougher decision for him had I been a little bit younger, maybe not getting ready to go off to college, and this door kind of opening up for him. So it was kind of perfect timing. But anyway, 2 weeks after I made my decision to go to San Diego State, he kind of came into my room and was like, listen, Coach Dietz is hanging on to this job for me when I'm ready to take it. I think after this year, it's going to be my last year. So at that point, you know, so long playing through Little League and high school, I had so many friends that had an opportunity to play for my dad. And as a kid, I always wondered what that would be like. And so here's my first opportunity for this to ever really have a shot. And so I had to get on the phone at Coach Horton, who was the head coach at Cal State Fullerton at the time. I had to get on the phone, call him, and like basically pull out of my verbal commitment. My dad was adamant that I had to make that phone call personally. He was actually really cool about it. He understood the kind of the gravity of the situation and let me out. Let me know if it didn't work out, I could come back. And so by the time, fast forward, when my dad actually, you know, decides he's going to retire, I was kind of already prepared and looking forward to it. And the first year that he was the hitting coach, he still wasn't around a lot because he was still doing ESPN. He was still working for the Padres at the time. So he was there, but he wasn't there. And I just remember my junior year, which was the first year he took over. As you said, it was probably one of the funnest times I've had playing a game. Very much the same way, Booney. Like my dad was coach when he was on the field. I understood that there was going to be a portion of people that felt like, although I had been there for 2 years and already had success prior to him being the head coach, there's going to be a segment of people that felt like I was being given this opportunity because my dad was the head coach. So I took it upon myself to make sure that everything I did on the field with him was above board in terms of player coach. I didn't want there to be any idea that I was being given, you know, favor. And a lot of that was going to be handled on the field, which I wasn't worried about. But in terms of, you know, during practice and in those times where, you know, you're in groups, I wanted to make sure that, you know, no one felt like there was a dad son thing going on the field. And so I had my best season as a junior when he was the head coach. And he treated it very much the same way. It was a mutual respect that of being a pro, even though I wasn't one at that time, of how to handle it. And I had a great, great season, a great time. It was the first time, that was the most time I ever got to spend with my dad. Usually, you know, because when I was younger, he was working, I was at school. This was like the most time we spent in the calendar year together. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, also, I mean, that's especially in the city of San Diego, carrying that Gwynn name. That's a big deal. That's not it's a good thing that you were a really good player, because, you know, it's like then that it would have been overwhelming, the right. Oh, father, dad, you know, father, son deal. I remember coming up with it. And, you know, for me, you know, we always have that as little kids. Oh, that's Tony Gwynn's son. Oh, Bob Boone's son when I was in Philly.
Right.
So, and I used to shove it off and go, I'm better than everybody else in this field. Who cares who my dad is? That was my attitude. And, but you, it's always there. You know, then you start to develop and you become a really good high school player. And now you're a really good college player, pro. But the questions for me, they never went away. And to this day, T, Ray Boone, my grandpa, who passed away in 2004, one of my, outside of being my gramps, he was just my guy. He was just, we had that relationship, just like I have it with my dad. We're very close. And he was always my biggest supporter, but not in front of me. When I was in the area, he would downplay, and then I'd walk away and be like, see that guy right there? He's going to be really good big leaguer. He's going to play for a long time. And I knew it. But anyway, I signed professionally. They start talking about this third generation thing. It had never happened before. For me and my family, it wasn't a big deal. We didn't care. I was pursuing my career. And I don't know about you, but every city I went to in the minor leagues, as I got closer, I got to AAA. And everywhere I went, it was, you know, do you feel the pressure to fill these big shoes? And I got to a point where I kind of resented it. And I started getting pissed. And I love my dad and I love my grandpa to death. And I have so much respect for what my family's accomplished in this game. But at the same time, it was like, I'm a 21-year-old kid. This is my time. Right. And it's like, look at my average. You see, I'm hitting 330. Who gives a shit about my dad and my grandpa? You know, and that's kind of the attitude. I started to get bitter about it. And I got to the, I said, they're not getting me to the big leagues. You know, they might have got me on a little league team, but they're not getting me to the big leagues. Now I get to the big leagues, and now once you establish stuff, that all goes away, but it was part of the process. Did you have a similar experience, or how did you embrace it? Being the son of Tony Gwynn, I mean, he won 8 batting titles.
Right.
That's a big deal.
Right. I think I had an early understanding that mountain was going to be extremely steep. And I could look at it two ways. I could be irritated and pissed off and resentful about it at times, or I could just embrace it and with the understanding of knowing that eventually it's going to be my play that is going to carve out whatever is said about me when it's all said and done. My dad at that point, especially being in San Diego, going to school in San Diego, a lot of that stuff, you know, were expectations that, you know, I was likely not going to reach in terms of, you know, hitting 375, chasing 400, hitting 300 every year of his career. I just understood that this game wasn't likely going to give me some of these same achievements. And I was okay with that. And so I set out to make my path what it was based on what I was going to do and my skill set. And I was content with however that played out. I knew in the minor leagues, honestly, that I was going to be, as you said, my numbers were going to speak for themselves. Like once I got to the minor leagues and I started to play every day and I started to go through that kind of journey and to get to the big leagues, ultimately, it didn't matter what my dad did. Those accolades were tremendous. They got him into the Hall of Fame. But as you said, none of that was going to help me get to the big league with the Brewers at the time. So I could stay, be pissed off about it, or I could just work to try to get there myself. Eventually, that's what I was able to do.
See, it was much easier for me. I do. I'm way better than my dad, way better than my grandma. But I didn't have to worry about hitting 400 to overcome them.
You know what, though?
I was chasing gold gloves with my dad, though.
Looking back on it, I wish I would have had a little more of that attitude. Because what I learned was, once I got to the big leagues, the guys who were the most confident, generally speaking, were the ones having success. And that confidence didn't waver whether they were 20 for 40 or 0 for 40. You generally got the same guy when we were talking about the dudes on any ball club that I was on that were superstars or were all-stars in that league. The confidence part is, I think, one of the biggest separators at the big league level.
And, you know, it's an interesting dynamic in my family because Aaron is not known as a brash, cocky guy. But, you know, I told you my attitude in AAA was get out of my way. I don't care who my dad and my grandfather is and kind of getting pissed about constantly being asked. I'll tell you what, the time I knew Aaron was going to be a big leaguer, he went through USC, had a nice career at USC. I think Aaron was a third round pick. But Aaron had that attitude. Because I'm sure, you know, I know what I went through in the minor leagues. Now Aaron's got that and one more. So right. now it's grandpa, dad, brother.
Yeah.
How are you going to do it? You know, but Aaron had that same attitude in a respectful way. It was like, screw what Brett's doing. It doesn't matter what he's doing. That doesn't get me anywhere. And he had that attitude. And from that moment, I knew Aaron's got a chance to play this game for a long time because of that attitude. I watched my youngest brother, Matthew, come along. He didn't have that attitude as much. It was more of his buddies in A-ball teasing him, hey, when are you going to make it? You know, and I think that affected Matthew.
Yeah.
Like he was really kind of worried about that. And Matty's a great kid and thriving now in the turf business. But I think if you ask him now as a 44-year-old man that went through it, I think he'll admit that, yeah, that kind of weighed on him, that pressure. Whereas Aaron didn't. Aaron was just like, screw Brett, I got to do this for me. And that's why he made it.
It's just dependent on the individual and, you know, that your mindset. I mean, that was you. I mean, that's how you were. Even after you started having success, when you came to San Diego, you still kind of had that chip on your shoulder.
Yeah,
I remember that. I remember it very well. Like, and that to me was a separator. That is a separator at the big league level. Because, you know, for those enough who are talented enough, you can get through the minor leagues kind of wavering on confidence at times. But once you get to the big leagues, that confidence has to be concrete at that point. And to me, that's the separator. And when I got to the big leagues, it took me a couple years before that it became concrete for me to have that confidence. Once it did, once I got traded here to San Diego is when it started to click for me. And I started to kind of, okay, this is who I am. I can stand 10 toes down on that every day when I take the field and feel pretty good about it.
Very cool. Yeah, retired in 14. What'd you think about going into broadcasting?
I didn't know I wanted to go into broadcasting immediately. I kind of, as I started to work, you know, one of the benefits of being around a big league locker room is if you're paying attention, there's a lot of lessons in there, right? As, you know, guys start to change teams or, you know, they fall out of the league, you start to realize that, you know, the game doesn't last forever. Eventually, your body and Father Time start to do their thing. And I wanted to be prepared one way or the other when that started to happen to me. So say in like 2011, 2012, I started kind of moving around, looking at different things, meeting different people. And I kind of just stumbled into the broadcasting thing after my last year in 15 with the Nationals. I got to do pre and post for the Dodgers in 16. Lon Rosen kind of gave me a job there. And then from there, it just kind of took off. I spent 1 year there and then came to San Diego. And it's really, to me, it's outside of coaching. It's really the next best thing, you know, in terms of being around the game every day. I get to travel with the team. I'm in every game. I'm watching every game, which I love. I just get to wash my hands with it a little bit earlier than I did as a player.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because now, you know, you change as you go through life and life hits you with different things. And I remember, you know, at the end of my career, when I was deciding that this was going to be it, I didn't want anything to do with baseball. You know, It's almost like I was mourning it. I wanted to quit because I was tired of it, but at the same time I mourned it because it's the only thing I've ever known,
right?
So I wanted nothing to do with it and I went away, and then 10 years later I find myself going, well, there's a lot of life left to live, you know. And you know, when I started this show, it's like it was a learning process. It was humbling, that the lessons you go through from how to prepare for an interview to how to broadcast to how to, and it's interesting, and it's kind of a good challenge for me now. But unlike you, unlike my brother, who, like you said, at the end of your career, you were kind of networking a little bit. What am I going to do next? I always, now, my advice to young players or players finishing up their career is, hey, keep your foot in the door in some capacity,
100%.
Whether it's broadcasting, whether it's coaching, just be involved. I'm telling you, because I went the other way where I just wanted nothing to do with it. I ran away for 10 years. And now it's like, hey, everybody, I'm back, you know? And it's a little bit, I'm having a great time doing this and we're making big strides, but it's different than when you just transition from career to, oh, now we'll go into the next career.
A couple things on that. I think the lessons you learn in when you first start this job are hilarious. I remember doing the post game show with Dave Vassay for the Dodgers. And, you know, in radio, you got, you know, people who advertise and they pay to do it. And, you know, this was my first lesson in, you know, locker room banter or, you know, talking like, you know, you have no care in the world can get you into trouble. There was an advertisement for a McDonald's something. I can't remember what it was. And just like off the cuff, just I was like, ugh, that doesn't make sense. I don't know if McDonald's should be doing that. We go to commercial and Dave, you know, he pulls me aside. He goes, hey, man, that's an advertiser. We can't be making jokes about the advertiser's food or whatever they're advertising. And I was so embarrassed for like
cough button.
See, I didn't know nothing about the cough button at the time, but it was a good experience and a lesson in terms of how the business works. And, you know, I felt the same way. You said you got away from baseball for about 10 years in terms of doing baseball stuff, the physical stuff. I had zero desire to do any of it, whether that was swing a bat, whether that was throw a baseball, even put my hand in a glove for about 3 years. I wanted nothing. I didn't want to do it. I wanted to talk about it. I still love the game. But in terms of putting some batting gloves on, taking some swings, throwing the baseball, it took me a while to get to a point where I actually wanted to do those things again. I think, you know, at least from my standpoint, I feel like I completely emptied the tank in terms of what I was able to put into the game. And when it was time to move on, it was time to move on from a physical standpoint. I still love the game and think the game as much as I did when I was playing. But in terms of the physical, it took me until maybe last year before I was like, you know what, let me see if I could still swing a bat and throw the ball a little bit. And as my son's gotten a little bit over, kind of been forced to kind of jump back into it a little bit.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, baseball, it's weird. I couldn't go to a game, Tony, and sit in the stands. I probably didn't go to a game and sit in the stands until about seven, 8 years after I retired. About 2015, I remember I went to a game with my dad, and we sat in the crowd, and I felt so strange. It's like, I haven't done this since I was a little kid sitting with my mom watching my dad. And it took me that long. Now it's, you know, it's easy. If my kids want to go see a game, we'll go to the game, sit in the crowd, and it's not a big deal. But
see, I wanted, that was the experience I wanted again, was to get in there and watch a game like a spectator, like I did when I was a kid. Because for so long, it had been all business when I was at the field. Right. I wanted to sit there and have a beer and watch a game. I'd never been able to do that.
All right, let's jump into the 2024 San Diego Padres. A year ago, we're sitting here. I had high expectations for this Padre team. I thought about, you know, the level of name recognition, star power, young star power. You got Soto, Machado, Tatis. You bring in Bogarts. That's a lot of young stars.
Yeah,
doesn't always work. Now, I'm not blaming it on that. I don't know what was happening. I wasn't in the clubhouse. You were a lot closer to the game than me. What made no sense to me at the end of the year when it was all said and done is they were top in the league in pitching with that star-studded lineup.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work. That's why this game is so great. And at the beginning of the season, we all, you know, we're all making predictions. And here's Tony's picks and Booty's picks and what's going to happen. And usually I get off the show that I'm doing and I start laughing, going, you know, everybody thinks that, boy, I've really studied this. I can give you an educated opinion, but it doesn't mean it's even going to come close to working out the way it did a year ago. We didn't expect that. A year ago, we didn't expect the Texas Rangers to win the World Series and the Arizona Diamondbacks give them a run like they did.
Yeah.
But that being over with, what's your outlook on 2024 for the San Diego Padres? Soto goes to New York. He's thriving early on in the season, and I think he's going to have a great season. I think you guys got some really good players in return. I like Peralta in the bullpen. I like King in the rotation. I think they're two real talented guys, and you still maintain, you know, that you still got Musgrove and Darvish. You added Cease. You got Machado. You got Tatis. You got a Bogarts. Cronenworth's off to a great start. Three legitimate MVP candidates year in and year out. Your outlook on the 2024 San Diego Padre team?
I feel really upbeat about this 2024 version. I think for the first time in, I would say since all of the moves started to be made in terms of the trade, bringing in Snell, bringing in Soto, bringing in Darvish. I think this is the first phase where they're giving some, they're inserting some young, you know, players that are controllable, that have a chance to be like impact players on a team. Jackson Merrill and Luis Camposano in particular are two young dudes who I think can help this team get to the where they're trying to go, which is deep into the postseason, into a World Series. You mentioned last year in the pitching. That was the mind-numbing thing about last year, is much as they struggled offensively early, they still were at the top in pitching really all season long. It was a combination of bad luck and, you know, poorly executed offensive spots, and particularly runners in scoring position, and just playing the game the way you need to in order to score runs. That being said, this year, you know, you lose Soto, and that deal is basically netted Peralta, as you mentioned, King, Brito, Vasquez, and Cease, because they turned around and flipped Thorpe and brought Cease in. So I think AJ has put them in a good spot this year. Now, the thing that has been noticeable from spring training is the attention to detail in terms of game planning and what they're trying to do at the plate. Last year, because you had, you know, you mentioned some of the names, at times it felt like everybody was just up there trying to blast a baseball, and it led to a lot of missed opportunities. This year, at least early, and this is all the way through spring training, when a guy needs to be moved, a guy is moved. When there's a ball that needs to get to the outfield or stay in the middle of the field to bring a run in, it's been executed. And it's clear that there's been attention. They've talked about this as a unit. And so that's been encouraging to see so far. It's early, obviously, so, you know, there's a lot of games to be played. But I like this team. I like where they're at. I think they're going to have to figure out roles in terms of the relievers. And when you're six games into it, at least from their standpoint, there's a lot of time to kind of figure that out. But I like the foundation that they built during spring training. And I think it could net them a lot more wins this year.
The thing I talked about a year ago, you know, because you rack your brain, like you said, it doesn't add up. The pitching was that good, and with that star-studded lineup, it almost mathematically doesn't add up to finish right where they finished.
Right.
But it's a combination of bad luck and just wrong place, wrong time. It's almost like an eclipse. Like, this is the perfect storm to have a terrible season.
Yeah.
The thing I was pointing to, and I didn't hear people talking about this much. I just talk about it because I come up, you know, and I'm a middle infielder, and I know the ego that comes along with being a middle infielder. Center field.
Yeah.
Captain of the outfielders.
Right.
Now, the shortstop's always the captain of the infield. He's always the best defender. He's the best defender on the field. He's the most skilled fielder. Nobody, except for Mookie Betts, and that remains to be seen. I've never seen anybody go to shortstop. Everybody leaves shortstop and goes somewhere else. But it's a very ego-driven, and I don't mean ego in a bad way, like in a jerky way. I just mean, hey, when you're a shortstop, you're a shortstop. It's kind of a demotion when you go over to my side of the bag and become a second baseman. You go to third base. No, it's shortstops. We all know shortstops are shortstops. All of a sudden, Tatis has that, you know, has his hiccup. He gets suspended for a year. He's got some hat in hand coming back to the ball club, kind of on his best behavior, and understandably. But he's a shortstop, and he's a young superstar. They put him in right field. Now, he won a platinum glove. That's great. I expect him to. I expect a shortstop to go to right field and win the glove. You got Cronenworth, a young, really good player who brings, he feels, and I know how it is as a second baseman. I felt like I brought a lot of value to second base. If you would early in my career put me at first base, I'd be like, are you kidding me? I'm a gold glove second baseman. That's where my value is. Who knows what's going through Cronenworth's brain? Like, wow, now I got to hit like a first baseman and my value's gone.
Yeah.
I'm not saying any of this happened, but that was kind of my thoughts. Like, you got a bunch of really talented defenders, but they're all out of position. You know, I look to this year, Bogarts, who seems like a great guy, veteran guy, has had a ton of success, mature player. He's asked to go over to second. I could imagine, I'm watching him say all the right things, right, but I could imagine thinking, wait a minute, they signed me for a lot of money to come here to play short, and all of a sudden I'm playing second. Okay, if that's what they want, he's got to be a team guy. I get that.
Yeah.
But just that was the underlying tone, if that could have had anything to do with a year ago.
That's a great point. And, you know, ideally in a perfect season for a team, you want everybody to be in a good mental space, right? And when you have that kind of movement, even though Toddy did everything that he was asked to do, he's coming back off the suspension and he goes out and win a platinum glove. You know, there's a part of it. I mean, prior to that season, he had said that, yeah, I'm going to right field. I'm going to do what the team's asking, but, you know, I still consider myself a shortstop, right? You got Cronenworth moving from second to first. And again, these guys are all good teammates. So they're going to do what is asked of them to do. And they're certainly not going to make any scuttle about it publicly and probably not even privately. But inside, he's definitely having that conversation with himself. Bogey, although he didn't have to be moved until this year at second, there was already conversations about it last year. So he's going in the shortstop position thinking, man, I got to come out here and show these guys I can still play this position. So it wasn't the best, probably in terms of putting those guys in the best mental space that they could be in. But they all ultimately, especially Toddy, he thrived in right field. I mean, as you said, he's a platinum glove winner. That probably kind of eased his mind a little bit. Bogey's at second this year. Crone's trying to bounce back. Maybe I think he's come in with a different mindset this year and he's benefiting from it early. But yeah, all those things, you know, probably were factors, you know, the bad luck, wrong place, wrong time, the mental space, all of that are contributing factors, I'm sure, to some of the seasons they had. I mean, Toddy, for instance, I mean, he won that platinum glove, but offensively, he had a great year by normal standards.
Right, not for him.
By his standards, he's still getting his feet wet all last year. So I expect him to have a big season this year.
Yeah, and it is, and it's tough, and it's not a knock against anybody. We all have our maturation processes come to fruition at different paces.
Yeah.
You know, some guys come to the big leagues, and for day one, it's like they've been there their whole career. And other guys, it's a process. And for most of us, it's a process. Mm-hmm. I even remember, and we'll go to the next thing here in a second. I want to cover the NL West and what you think of the rest of the teams. But back to the shortstop thing. I remember it was 1994, my first year in Cincinnati. Barry Larkin's the shortstop. He's the captain. He's the young, you know, the young all-star is going to be there his entire career. And we traded for a veteran World Series champ, Tony Fernandez from the Toronto Blue Jays, has won several gold gloves at short.
Yeah.
We sign him, comes to camp, spring training. Now this is a veteran player, been there, done that. Like I said, gold gloves, World Series champ. I expect him to be an adult. Tony Fernandez did not talk to anybody for probably 3 weeks into spring training. He went out, he took his ground balls at shortstop with a blue Toronto Blue Jay glove, wouldn't talk to Larkin, and said, I'm a shortstop. I don't play third base. That's the ego I'm talking about. Well, Davey Johnson's our skipper, and he sees this problem brewing. And Tony's like, I want to go back to Toronto. Well, we got you from Toronto. That's not how this works. Finally, it was like breaking a young horse. It's like, finally, we broke him. By the end of spring, he accepted. He played third base. Played one of the best third base that 94 season I've ever seen to this day. And he passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
One of the greatest teammates I've ever had. I mean, I enjoyed Tony Fernandez more than I enjoyed 99% of my teammates. And 3 weeks into spring training, I'm looking at this guy. I don't even know him. I'm going, what is he doing? Larkin is the shortstop. That is the writing on the wall. He's the young. You got to kind of go to third, but that's how hard it is, even for a veteran, established player. till finally we convinced him, like, our team's going to be the best with you at third. As soon as he accepted that, he put his blue glove away, went and got a normal glove, played an unbelievable third. I don't know if he won a gold glove that year. And like I said, was one of the best teammates and kindest men I've ever been around. But that just shows you what it's like for a veteran. I could imagine when you're young, without going through that, it's an adjustment.
It also is a peek into the type of mindset you got to have success, right? Like,
that was
fight or flight, kind of coming out right there when he didn't want to move off of short. But eventually, as you said, you guys were able to show him, all right, listen, it's not like you're not playing. You just got to slide over to the next position, man.
Tony, it was hilarious. We'd be taking our, you know, during infield, we'd take our ground balls. I'd be turning two with Lark, and Tony's right in there. And Lark's looking at me like, what is this guy doing? He's playing third. But Tony refused. He's like, I'm not playing third base, Brett. I'm not. It was awesome. And like I said, what an awesome guy. All right. You know, our preseason came out, all this. I am really impressed with the NL West what it's done, especially really sneaky and late. They got Snell. But the Giants really made some big moves this offseason. The Dodgers, they're the super team. We all know that. I've still got questions about the Dodgers. Arizona, that unbelievable run and the confidence that they probably accrued by that run as a young team. They've added on. I think they're considerably better. I think it's the best division in all of baseball. That remains to be seen. Your takes will go one at a time. Let's go with the Giants.
You know, they in particular have had such a hard time over the past three off seasons trying to lure that big fish. And regardless of how this big fish came to them, they were patient enough to be in the right spot at the right time. And, you know, I think Brandon Blake is a huge, huge get for them, especially in that ballpark. I hated playing at that place. It's just not a fun place to play. It's cold. Ball doesn't go anywhere. He is going to, I think he's going to thrive there. I think it's a bonus that Bo Mel is there too, because the one thing I can tell you about Blake is, he is a creature of comfort. Once he's comfortable is when you get his best. There was a reason why it was up and down the first couple seasons. He just hadn't got comfortable. He had a new pitching coach, and then he had another new pitching coach, and then Ruben kind of got in there. He settled, and then you got what you got, which was a Cy Young. I think it's good that Bo Mel is there. He'll have a familiar face and someone he knows and can trust. To help him get going. After watching the four games, Jung Ho Lee is a dude that is a lot farther ahead than what Ha-Seong Kim was when he came over to the big leagues. I mean, everything about him in terms of how he puts together an at-bat, the way he can go get it defensively, he just understands the game really well. I think he's a further ahead, and I think that's a bonus for them. Obviously, the other pieces, you know, with Webb there, they have added the right kind of pieces. So they're no longer this team that, you know, has to platoon different guys. They actually have a solid base now. And they'll still do the platoon thing in certain spots, but I think that team is a very, very impressive. They had the bullpen looks really good for the Giants right now. So they got a lot of good things working.
Yeah, I agree with you on the home field advantage. I tell that to people all the time. I said, what people don't talk about, and they won those games, those World Series with Boach on the off years, three in that short period. Nobody likes to go to San Francisco and play. It's cold in the middle of the summer. It's acting like it's winter. Yep. And for you, a left-handed hitter, right field, over to center, it's as big a ballpark in the history of ballparks. It's horrible. Yeah. I hated playing. Candlestick was a nightmare. Then I didn't like playing there. Oakland's always cold and dewy, and the ball doesn't go anywhere. And it, I think it's a built-in home field advantage. Now you add these players that we mentioned, and they added Chapman at third. I think that really shores up their defense. Solar hit 36 homers a year ago. What I'm interested to see is not only Snell. If Snell can be the guy he was a year ago, coupled with Webb. And they got a guy by the name of Robbie Ray, who won a Cy Young a few years ago, fell a little bit below expectations in Seattle, coming back from Tommy John. Sometimes guys come back stronger. It's going to be really interesting to watch that rotation to what's already, for me, a stellar NL West. Let's move to Arizona Diamondbacks. A year ago, unbelievable run they went on. If you said they were going to the World Series, I think you're lying. But we all watched it. They've only gotten better. They added Montgomery. Eugenio Suarez came over from the Seattle Mariners. I'm looking at who else they got. Gallen and Kelly at the top of that rotation. They re-upped Gurriel, Moreno, Rodriguez they signed, I believe, from Detroit.
Yep.
Perdomo at short. I really liked him. I think he made two or three errors a year ago. Your take on the Arizona Diamondbacks?
I think you hit on it as we led into this. The confidence that they gain from going to the World Series, I'm sure, is more than perhaps what you could do bringing in somebody, right? I mean, they've already did it with the group, the core group that they have. And so their confidence is already bubbling. So now you add Eugenio Suarez, who he comes in from Seattle to shore up the third base spot that Longo was at. You miss a Perdomo. He kind of came into his own last year. So he's coming back in with a boatload of confidence. You have Marte back, you know. They have, I mean, and obviously Carroll is the guy that makes that offense kind of go. And so all these guys are coming back. You throw on top of that Eduardo Rodriguez. They have a team that you're going to have to deal with. Now, are they going to be better than they were last year? I think it remains to be seen. I think, to me, even though they've gone to the World Series, they're still in a kind of prove it mode, right? Because a lot of the guys are in their second year of being, you know, trying to keep that level of play up. And so the one thing that the Diamondbacks are always going to be, especially with Lovello at the helm, is they're going to be well coached. They're going to play the game, right? And they're going to press you. They're not a team that is fearful of, you know, whatever your roster is. They think they can go out and win, and they can do it a whole bunch of different ways. They can slug. They're probably one of the best base running teams in terms of pressing you, going first to third, being able to steal bags. I remember early in the season last year, it was before everybody started to settle. They hit Carroll, McCarthy, and the young center fielder, his name is Thomas, back to back to back. And it turned into an absolute track meet, and there was nothing we could do about it at all. And so I know those guys aren't hitting close. That's just the kind of talent that they have on that team. And so they're going to be a team that's you're going to have to do it. As you said, National League West is probably the best division in baseball. You know, obviously the Rockies, I don't know exactly what they're doing at this point, but
yeah, Rockies, they're the team that really kind of, they're the Oakland A's of the AL West.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting with these new rules in the game and the two disengagements, the rule, I think these, you're going to see more and more. And I see what they're doing now. They didn't want to change the game. They want to encourage the guys to start running again. Saw it a year ago with the base stealing numbers were really up. I think that's good for the game. And I think it gets back to playing a little more old-fashioned baseball, which I think a lot of people love. I think the last time we really saw it was probably in 2016 when the Royals won. They had that type of team that went first to third, ran the bases, you know. And
Diamondbacks in a lot of ways remind me of the Angels when they were in that early.
Oh, with Socia.
Oh, my gosh.
Unbelievable.
If you, as an outfielder, you used to go into that series and you knew if
there
was any mistake at all, they were going to capitalize on it every time. That's who the Diamondbacks kind of remind me of.
Yeah, and it puts pressure on the outfielder. Just that simple throw.
Yep.
It becomes a no. I know they're going to run right in my face. I remember, I'm going to tell this quick story. There was a guy named Sean Figgins, early 2000s.
Remember Sean? Yep.
And Sean could run the bases. And I'll tell you, I knew we'd go infield in, Sean Figgins on third base. They're going on contact. even though I'm standing on the grass. Right. And, you know, I'm sitting there. Don't they know who I am? That sucker would run on me and throw me into a full panic. Like, nobody runs on me when I'm infield in. I'll tell you what, Sean Figgins did, and they made my wheels start spinning. I remember our pregame meetings was like, these guys will run. Ichiro, you know how nobody's used to running on you? They will run on you, so be ready. They don't care. Yeah. You know, and you find the more pressure you put on people, you can get people to make mistakes. It's really interesting. But I think the team that really embraces these new rules and really runs the bases, I think you're going to see a lot of success from that type of baseball. Putting the ball in play, running the bases like we used to run the bases.
It was like last year, the teams that did it seemed like they were doing it out of necessity because the rules were new. They didn't have the roster to kind of like outslug you. So they take on that, we're going to run the bases. But I think by the end of the last season, I think all 30 teams started to see where the value was in it. And you're already starting to see roster comfort, you know, the way they can form a roster now, you're starting to see it change a little bit. And it's because those rules exist that you can take advantage of.
And that brings us to the bad guys in the division, the Dodgers, who obviously start the offseason with the Yamamoto signing, the Shohei Ohtani signing. This roster, they're so deep. For me, I want you to give me your take on what I've been calling a super team, the LA Dodgers. Yes. Yeah. And then, but I have a couple concerns. I'll touch on those after I get Tony Gwynn Jr.'s take on the LA Dodgers.
I mean, listen, when you bring in a guy like Shohei Ohtani alone, right, that changes the dynamic of your team, especially when you add him to a bunch of winners that they have already in Mookie and Freddie and Will Smith. I mean, Jay Hay. I mean, they have a lot of talent, but they have a bunch of really good locker room guys that can kind of keep the ship in order, because as you mentioned, when you got a lot of egos, it can make it a little bit more difficult, but they have a good makeup in terms of how this roster is put together. Now, they're the creme de la creme of Major League Baseball, not just the National League. They are the team in terms of paper, the team to beat. Now, we saw him for 2 games. I'm interested to see, I know he had a better performance, but Yamamoto, I want to see if he's going to stick with his fastball, because when you watch it, it's pretty straight. There isn't a lot of movement on it. And typically in the past, when we've seen pitchers from Japan come over, they start out throwing that fastball. And if there's not a lot of movement at the big league level, no matter how hard it is, it's going to get hit. What happens at that point? His command in his last start, where he didn't get the decision, was much better, because he was – when you're throwing 97 in the middle of the plate, even at this level, it's going to get hit. And that's what happened in that first start. He was getting hit around, balls in the middle of the plate. I'm interested to see how he adjusts in terms of how he's going to use his fastball at the big league level. I don't see a lot of flaws with this Dodger team. The defense might be the thing that can come back and bite him. How is Mookie going to transition over? I think he'll be fine. Second base with Gavin, he's got the I don't want to say the yips,
the
he's got something going on.
I'll say it. He's got the thing. He was supposed to be the shortstop.
He was right. And so this is, they've had the kind of ad lib already. Third base, we saw that earlier. How's Max going to? I know he's put himself in better shape to hopefully be able to move a little bit better. I think that's going to be a question mark. So defensively is where I see them having some issues. If that's going to be the spot, they're going to get Walker back at some point to add to this rotation that already has, you know, some studs in it, some young studs at that. But as we saw last year, no matter how good it looks on paper, you still got to go out and win the games on the field. Can they do that? That remains to be seen.
Yeah, I look at this team and you can't find a better threesome than a Betts, Ohtani, Freddie Freeman. That's as good as it gets.
Nope.
And it's a long lineup too. You got the Outman kid in center field, really good player. You got the catcher. They just signed him to they just signed him to a 10-year deal. Underrated catcher, really
very good underrated player.
I mean, that's Muncy. You know, he's gonna hit you 35 home runs. But my questions are similar to yours. If Mookie Betts makes this transition to shortstop and is a solid shortstop for 150 plus games, it'll be one of the most impressive things I've ever seen in baseball.
Without a doubt.
Because you can't just do that. I could go to second base, play it all day long. But if you came to me and said, Booney, shortstop went down, we're going to need you to play short this year. You talk about a full panic. I can't do it. I can fill in maybe for a couple games. That ball at me to my left, I'll make it look like I've been playing short my whole life. But I go into that hole, my feet get all tangled up. That's why I played second base. Plus, I didn't have that cannon of an arm from short. But if he does it, I don't think people will recognize how impressive that is to just, oh, I played short in high school. I'm a right fielder in the big leagues. And on this super team now in 2024, I'll just shore up the defense by playing short for you. No problem. I talked to Jerry Harrison. He said, Booney, if anybody can do it, it's this guy. From what I've seen early, I agree. I mean, if not the best athlete at the in the game right now, definitely in that conversation as the best athlete. That's going to be really interesting for me to see. I watched Yamamoto's first start. He kind of reminded me, he pitched like Tanaka, the pitcher for the Yankees.
Just control
that split, but almost like I'm scared to throw the fastball. When you get hitters, big league hitters, and especially really astute lineups, knowing you're scared of the fastball, you're in trouble because they're going to get up in the box, sit on your neck, and that split's great. But you got big league hitters sitting on it every time, and you prove to them you're scared to throw the fastball. That's another adjustment that's going to have to be made. He's been great. I'm not saying we're two starts in.
Yeah.
I don't want to get ahead of myself. This guy obviously is pretty coveted to get that kind of money. He did a great job in Japan. That remains to be seen. That's a question for me. But then I look at that rotation. Now, if everything goes great, everybody's healthy. If Glasnow's great for 30 plus starts, he's a bona fide number one for me. No question about it. You get into a Walker Buehler. He comes back and is the Walker Buehler we know. Unbelievable. That's first tier. Who else we got? Kershaw. He's coming back. It's kind of nice, even though Kershaw's getting up there in age, having him as your fifth starter. That's pretty good.
Slow play that one too with the depth they have.
And this kid that pitched that I watched, Miller. He looks nasty.
Yeah.
So it's no question that the Dodgers have the talent top to bottom, but there are question marks. Glasnow hasn't proven that he can stay healthy. Walker Buehler is not on the field. Yamamoto is not a proven commodity. So, yes, if everything goes as planned, this is a super team. But still, there's a lot of what ifs, and I've got to see them before I just say, they're going to win 115 games this year. We'll see. That remains to be seen. Your call, Padres a year ago won 82 games, won 82 and 80. What's the over-under for Padres wins this year for you? I'll set it at 90. Tony Gwynn, over or under?
Oh, 90 might be the number.
Yeah?
90 might be the number. I mean, they finished, 82 and 80 last year? On a really underachieving team, 90 would be a strong number for him this year. I think it takes about maybe what it took last year to be the last wild card. You know what, 85, I think it was by the Diamondbacks.
For me, mathematically, there could be four teams from this division go to the playoffs.
Think so. That means
it could happen.
That definitely could. It's going to be a fight. In terms of the four getting in, I think it's Philly's the team that could prevent, you know, one of those teams from getting in there. But they're the National League West is that good where it could have four teams in there for sure.
They're the only division where I look at the four teams, and if they all have good years, especially because of the competitive balance now where they don't beat each other up in their own division.
Exactly.
If everything went according to plan for these four teams, the top four teams in the NL West, I could see them all having the ability to win 90 plus games, all four of them.
Yeah. And not having the schedule the way it used to be is going to aid in that, right? They don't have to play each other as much as they did. So that means, you know, if it plays out the way it looks in terms of the Central, I mean, that's where you're going to be able to make your ends meet in terms of beating up on that Central. Now, it never actually plays out the way we think it does. It never, ever. Maybe at the top it does, but everywhere else, it never works out that way.
Never. And I think I know what I'm talking about. And I pretend to, and then at the end I go, how was I to know that was going to happen? Tony, hey, man, I appreciate you coming on. This has been a lot of fun reminiscing and getting your take on the NL West. I will catch up with you sometime down the road this year. I wish the Padres nothing but the best and you nothing but the best. I appreciate you being a guest on the Boone Podcast. For all you out there watching now on YouTube, I appreciate you tuning in. For you listening to the Boone Podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your downloads or downloads your podcast. I appreciate you tuning in. Till next time, I'll be right here.